Greetings to everyone, and welcome to today's Nano Forum Answers webinar. My name is Ephraim Masawe, and I'm pleased to present this overview of our collaborative initiative on the applications of nanotechnology for safe and sustainable environmental remediations. Next slide, please. As you can see, we have a great panel of speakers today, and I invite you to read their bios at our Nano Forum website, which is available at Southeastern Louisiana University or at the Nano Hub org at Purdue University. Let me give you a brief introduction of the panelists. I'm an associate professor of occupational safety, health, and environment at Southeastern Louisiana University, Hammond, Louisiana, and I'm pleased to serve as a coordinator for the Nano Forum initiative. Greg Gervas is Chief of EPA Technology Assessment Branch. Inge Jan Slansk is Director of the Nano Iron Company in Europe. Dr. Charmin Soon, who is joining us soon, is a soil scientist at the EPA lab in Oklahoma. Dr. Mark Hoover is a Senior Research Scientist at the NIOSH. And Dr. Lorraine Day serves as the Safety Program Administrator at the LSU, Center for Advanced Microstructures and Devices, and is also an adjunct professor in the Center for Energy Studies. We'll take one or two questions after each of their presentations, and we'll have a Q&A session at the end of the webinar. I hope you'll both learn and enjoy during each of the sessions that will be presented. Let us begin. Next slide, please. Let us begin with the objectives. We founded the Nano Forum initiative in 2011 to provide a coordinated opportunity for representatives from across our environmental and occupational health remediation community, including industry, academia, and government, to share perspectives and to develop ideas to become familiar with one another and to share successful case studies of nano-enhanced technologies. Next slide, please. In addition, our objectives include a focus on occupational and environmental regulatory issues, on the fate and transport of nanomaterials during and after remediation, on the details of nano-associated hazards, exposures, and the resulting risks, on sharing and updating the results of a nanoinformatics survey that we conducted across state and local programs, and on the advancing opportunities for developing and sustaining collaboration. Please visit our website for additional information and opportunity to become involved. Next slide, please. As you can see, our inaugural Nano Forum workshop, which was held in 2013, had a planning committee comprising of experts from across the federal government departments and the agencies, academia, professional organizations, and private entities. At the conclusion of the workshop, our organizing committee met for half a day to prepare a workshop proceedings for sharing on our website and to plan a series of follow-up activities, and one of those activities is this webinar we're having today. Our planning committee also agreed that a key to our success and positive impact in the remediation world would be the creation and application of a robust informatics framework and process for developing and sharing relevant and reliable information. Next slide, please. On this slide, you can see that the Nano Forum initiative has a great and dedicated team of organizing committees. Like I said, they all come from different sectors. Ephraim Masawe is a committee chair, Janet Akada, Lorraine Day, Greg Gervas, Michael Gill, Mark D. Hoover, Daniel McCarthy, Martha Otto, Charmin Sue, and Sebastian Van Delden. You're welcome to contact any of these members for further information about the Nano Forum initiative and, of course, how you can become involved. Next slide, please. This slide shows the numerous supporting organizations that we have had and they continue to sustain this initiative up to this moment. We thank you, all of these agencies. Next slide, please. Our 2013 summer inaugural workshop opened with poster and exhibition sessions followed by podium sessions. And one of the sessions was organizational perspectives from the federal, local, and state agencies. Next slide, please. The workshop continued with a session that focused on nanoinformatics. This included tools for safe and sustainable handling of practices for environment, engineered nanoparticles, ENPs, empowerment of local and state governments for nanotechnology oversight, and the online community for nano research and education, which is hosted by Purdue University under the auspices of the National Science Foundation. Next slide, please. Our third podium session focused on occupational safety and health aspects of engineered nanoparticles and on the approaches for assessing the safety of nanotechnology in remediation in particular. Next session, please. Our fourth podium session provided practical examples of the science of nano-enhanced remediation and non-remedial application of engineered nanoparticles, ENPs. Presenters discussed the challenges, the risks, and also the future direction of research. They also presented use of nano-zero valent iron and the results of pilot-scale studies here in the U.S. and in Europe. Current issues and concerns were also presented. And also the final presentation focused on functional procedures in managing nanomaterials. Next slide, please. Podium session 5 and 6 covered safety issues and risk management from the EPA perspective. EPA had started and conducted a site study at South Carolina site where chlorinated solvents had been used in the past. Case studies, discussions, and reporting among the presenters and the attendees. These case studies were very informative and engaging to all participants at that workshop. Next slide, please. So, to conclude this overview of the Nano4M initiative, the organizing committee and I invite you to be part of this path forward, at least to build on the success of our inaugural summer workshop, which was held in 2013, and to confirm to our stakeholder needs, including both those of you who have participated from the onset and those of you who are learning about this initiative for the first time. We also want to understand your needs and ensure that they are being met. To do that, we want to refine our Nano4M informatics framework and the process that is involved. And finally, we would also want to invite you to use that framework and process to develop and share relevant and reliable information for impact both here in the U.S. and around the world. Next slide, please. So thank you all for your attention. Please partner with us to advance Nano4M Answers Initiative. And before I turn the presentation back to Ms. Ballant, our moderator, let me take this opportunity to say a few words of thanks and gratitude to EPA, particularly Engineer Greg Gervas, Mike Gill, and Jean Ballant for their generous offer of this technology, which we are able to use today for our webinar event. Back to you, Jean. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Misawe. We did have a quick question that came in regarding the event that you held. Are there any plans to have a similar summit in the future?
Depending on financial resources and interest generated from this webinar, we might also convene another conference in the future.
Okay, so I think I might invite our participants, if you are interested in either attending or participating in such a future summit, to include that in your feedback after today's session. Would that be helpful for you?
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
All right, excellent. We also, and they also ask, is this going to be covered at the Battelle May 2016 events or conference? Do you know if you'll be participating there?
I didn't get the question right. Could you repeat the question?
Certainly. We just had one additional question ask if you will be participating or talking about this topic at the upcoming Battelle May 2016 conference.
Most probably I will be participating in that conference, yes.
All right, excellent. Thank you very, very much. Let's move on to our next topic in today's agenda, and we're going to switch gears and turn things over to our next presenter, Greg Gervais, who's joining us from EPA as the Chief of the Technology Assessment Branch. Greg, if you're ready to begin, please go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me, Jean?
We can.
Great. Thanks, everybody, and good morning. I appreciate all the interest and the participation in today's webinar. I'd like to especially thank Dr. Ephraim Massawi, who's extremely modest, the initiative that he talked about in his introductory remarks and the workshop that we had in 2013 was something that he conceived and he substantially organized and obviously led. So I very much thank him for his leadership in this area of examining the different facets of nano for remediation. It's very much helping to lead this discussion in the remediation field, not only in the United States, but around the world. And I think you'll all enjoy the talks we have today for our webinar. So I'm going to talk just briefly about engineered nanoparticles for site remediation. What EPA and the Superfund program in particular is doing with regard to tracking the usage talk a little bit about where kind of the perceptions and the realities might be right now for use of nanomaterials. For the benefit of some of our webinar participants who may not be highly familiar with nanomaterials, just real briefly, these are materials generally in the context of remediation, they're engineered materials. And what is the nano part of this? Well, generally it's materials who have at least one physical dimension, X, Y, and Z, that's less than approximately 100 nanometers, which means one of those dimensions is no bigger than, and probably much smaller than, 1/1000th the diameter of a human hair. So this is extremely, extremely small material, which gives it many of the interesting and useful properties that people are interested in looking to apply nanomaterials, not just in remediation, but in pretty much every industrial and market, commercial market sector. So with that as context, let's proceed. So again, in part because of the size of these materials, and there's other factors involved, but it gives some really interesting, unique, and powerful characteristics of these engineered nanoparticles, these nanomaterials that can be leveraged to help with remediation. Much of the existing body of information, in particular what we in the EPA Superfund program have been tracking, it goes back for us about 10 years. Much of it has been focused on in situ chemical reduction of organic contaminants and groundwater and their sources, as well as some metals like chromium that are amenable to chemical reduction to reduce their toxicity, or in the case of those VOCs, reduce them down to much less problematic hydrocarbons. Many contaminants can be remediated using these sorts of nanomaterials, again, with a focus on chemical reduction, Much of the work to date has been in the examination of nano-zero-valent iron for chemical reduction of chlorinated VOCs. Polychlorinated biphenyls, halogenated aromatics, hexavalent chrome, other compounds are susceptible. You know, other nanomaterials are utilized as well, you know, titanium oxides, palladium-based nanomaterials, combinations of metals known as bimetallic nanomaterials have also been used. Typical applications to date have included not only as chemical reductants that are injected or otherwise placed in the ground to treat material in situ, but also looking at applications with vertical engineered barriers, permeable walls, where the contaminated water flows through them, and reactive sediment caps. Some more recent research is ongoing associated with use in sediment caps. In addition to that, you know, some of the realities are similar to micro or larger scale materials used for particularly for oxidation and reduction. Doing it ex situ, say in the water treatment plant environment, has proven much more straightforward and you know, from a technical standpoint, easier than in situ. Yeah, that's the case for nano. It's the case for larger size materials. Agglomeration, which is where the nanoparticles end up sticking together, if you will, and it impedes how it can move through the subsurface and become something where its small size can be used and come in contact with contaminants. It can be challenging, and work is being done in the research world as well as the vendor marketplace to do treatments of or other things within the fabrication of engineered nanoparticles to overcome the agglomeration, as well as some of the challenges with dispersing the contaminants in situ to get good coverage to allow for the surface chemical reactions to occur. Storage and handling have been safety issues in the past, as I think you'll learn with one of our later talks today from Jan, that the technology developers and vendors put a lot of time and effort into addressing storage, particularly the shelf life, if you will, of the nanomaterials, as well as handling safety. And the cleanup practice has advanced over the last 10 years in particular to address those issues. Cost, obviously, is a big challenge relative alternative materials or alternative technologies. And again, with the advancement of the technology, the right purpose and use for individual technologies, is something that's examined very much on a site-specific basis based upon the specific conditions and considerations at any one site where you're looking for it. The potential use of nanomaterials as an engineered nanoparticle driven remedy, the process is going to look very similar to examining non-nanomaterials or technologies for use at any one site. And of course, with any technology, as things advance, become better known, and those uses of those technologies and those materials become more and more routine, more and more reliable and predictable. For our sake, as I've said, we've been tracking the use of engineered nanoparticles for remediation, particularly at Superfund sites, but other waste sites in the United States for about 10 years now. And the tracking is very difficult, and it's very difficult in that it's not always straightforward to determine kind of at a national level from our national Superfund program office when these materials are being used. And in a way, that's a good thing because I think it was much easier to find these, and the figure that you're all seeing now is a map with a catalog of several dozen known pilot scale or full scale applications of engineered nanoparticles for site cleanup, not just Superfund sites, but other waste sites within other regulatory cleanup programs. Much of these identifications were done in the 2009 to 2010 timeframe. It's become more and more difficult for us to identify pilot and full-scale use of these engineered nanoparticles for remediation in the United States. We think in part it's because their use is becoming more mainstream. They're not, you know, they're very powerful and somewhat new relative to other technologies and materials for use on remediation sites, but their use is becoming more commonplace, and therefore it's a little bit more subtle to find their use because they're frankly being utilized in a more mainstream way than ever before. And I'm going to breeze through my next few slides here so we can do the handoff to the next presenter. But in particular, we've looked quite a bit at nano ZVI for reduction. As I've said, other materials are progressing with its R&D and application at sites. For EPA's sake, it is being selected. Engineered nanoparticles are being used on Superfund sites. Things are progressing from screening and selection or pilot scale into full-blown use. In 2016, a site within Ohio is going to be using at full scale nano ZVI for treatment of tetrachloroethylene and other POCs in a bedrock aquifer. And we're pretty excited to see how that full-scale remediation goes, to partner with our regional office, with the state of Ohio, and with the responsible party to collect and share information on that application. Again, there's perception issues with any technology or any newer technology, but work is being done to collect real information and to share that on ZVI, the longevity of it, how long it stays active, if you will, in the surface, on the subsurface in particular. The ENP is within the regulatory framework because it is an emerging material. People are still looking at its safe, appropriate application, making sure there aren't unacceptable consequences or other issues that arise by its use. The European Union is putting forward leadership, really examining nanomaterials, their safe and effective and appropriate use on waste sites. And we're pretty excited to track the progress of the NanoRem initiative with the European Union. Key questions, obviously, safe for use, potential worker safety issues, potential impacts on nearby residents, neighbors, and potential implications on the environment. Again, that work is being done, continues to happen. As I said, we've tracked use of nanomaterials for about 10 years now. On the Kulin website that our office maintains, we have information on nanotechnology and nanomaterials research, particularly for remediation on those list of sites. A little bit of a shameless plug with the work that when our participants do, as you become aware or you potentially use on some of your cleanup sites, engineered nanoparticles, feel free to share that information with us. We love to find out where it's being used, how it's being used, and in particular, the effectiveness and the cost effectiveness of the technology, because as the remediation practice continues forward, we all benefit from having good information on performance and cost of remedial technologies. As far as just, again, screening, this information is really helpful. We try and share that with folks at Kulin.org website as a primary vehicle, as well as these webinars for doing so. And we'd like to share best practices. So as nano applications for remediation occur, as practitioners, as researchers are bringing those conferences, it very much helps push the science, helps disseminate the information, and it benefits the remediation community as a whole. Peer-reviewed science, as well as case studies, are also very helpful and desirable. As an example, at the previous Patel conference that the questioner for Dr. Massawi asked if he'll be participating in the 2016 event. In the 2014 event, there was a session on advances in nanotechnology. And so you can see this is something that's becoming more and more mainstream and brought to these big professional conferences. In summary, the technologies are maturing. They're becoming more mainstream in their use. And I think that's an example of not only the novelty is going beyond just being novel and is actually being demonstrated for effective use and remediation. And we look forward to continuing to track and monitor and share information on engineered nanoparticles and nano-4 remediation moving forward. And again, we've got information on the EPA homepage, more broadly on nanoscience. On the CLUIN webpage, we have a focus area, and we have a searchable database on case studies for use of remediation using nano, and we look forward to adding more of those. Again, if you have information, please share that with us. We'd love to collect more case studies and distribute those. And then the NanoREM initiative in the EU is also of great interest for us. And with that, I thank you for your time and your interest today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Greg. We did have a number of questions come in regarding your topic, but I think in the interest of time, I'm going to hold those to our Q&A period towards the end and move on to the very next presenter. So thank you so much, and you can stay on with us for later on. Moving right along to our next presenter, we'll be joined by Jan Slinsky, who is a director at NanoIron. Jan, if you are on the line, I'm going to go ahead and unmute you now, and you should be able to feel free to begin your presentation whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Jane, and greetings, everyone. My name is Jan Slonsky, and I present today our perspective on DVI nanoparticles that are used mainly in groundwater remediation. I would like to say that my presentation, there won't be any information about, general information about nanoparticles, what's nano, why DVI. I think you can read a lot of information on the internet about this theme. So I would rather focus on our personal experience from past years, and also which comes also from the great cooperation with other remediation companies, mainly in Czech Republic, and the cooperation with universities. So what we are doing, we are not doing it we are not doing it alone, but the results are based on some cooperation efforts. So, after a short introduction on NDVI characteristics, the processing and application of this material will follow, and then some quality control, toxicity, transport studies, and finally technology implementation, including field remediation experience, will be discussed in my presentation. So I'm working at NanoIron company for 6 years, where our main activity is production and delivery of nanoscale zero-valent iron materials, including technical support. We are not a remediation company, but we are doing our best to help our clients to have successful applications. Here are some short information about our products. So we have our particles 15 nanometers in diameter and average surface area about 25 square meters per gram, which provides very high reactivity to particles. There are plenty of methods known for production of nanoparticles. You can see some of them on this short list. And every method has, of course, some advantages and disadvantages. For the purpose of this presentation, I divide products into two groups, products manufactured as a dry powder and as a slurry. The dry powder has the advantage of no aging, resulting in unlimited shelf time, but it requires some processing into a water form for the application. Water slurry is, on the other hand, ready to apply product, but it's aging due to the presence of water. And high reactivity of nanoparticles causes fast transformation of reactive zero-valent iron nanoparticles to non-reactive iron oxide in water environment. So this aging issue is quite important theme, especially in the case of this product. Please see the graph showing the gradation of water slurry depending on the storage condition. So you can see that the gradation is much faster at ambient temperature in water slurry. So the product shall be applied quite fast and shouldn't be stored for a long time. Liquid phase reduction using borohydride is probably the most known method for the direct slurry production, while we decided to use dry phase production, which is more complicated, but it has some advantages on the other hand. Here is a map of our products. You can see we have two basic dry powders, pyrophoric 25P and air-stable nanofirstar. By dispersing of this powders in a liquid, we can get various slurry products. Nanofir 25 contains just nanoparticles and water, so it's very reactive. We can add some organic modifier to prepare Nanofir 25 as the modifier improves mobility and makes the product more stable. We can also add some vegetable oil, for example, into the mixture of nanoparticles and water and some other stuff to prepare emulsified zero-valent iron. And by this approach, we can, of course, prepare any custom-made product containing zero-valent iron nanoparticles. Here is a short specification of an air-stable powder, as I told you about. You can see, hopefully here on the picture, very thin iron oxide shell on the particles that protect the particles from the further oxidation in the presence of air oxygen. And the oxide layer also suppresses the pyrophoricity of the original product. So it makes safer for handling and further processing. But it still keeps the former reactivity of the original product. If you remember the graph showing aging of NDDI slurry at the beginning of my presentation, you can guess that the successful application is also a matter of time. Two approaches are presented here. The first, conventional delivery process, starts with the production of NDDI slurry in a factory, followed by shipping, storage, dilution, and injection on the site. The whole process can take a few days or a few months, depending on the distance of production facility and the application site, precision in planning, weather conditions, and other aspects. In the second case, we can deliver dry powder directly to the site together with equipment. Besides saving the transportation costs of the water, which is included in the water slurry product, it gives us the possibility to prepare fresh, most reactive slurry and apply it in the same day. It means practically no aging of the product. The equipment used for the dilution of the product also minimizes the contact with personnel. So it automatically doses the product to the injection machine depending on what injection technology is used. The point is to reduce the contact of with the nanomaterial with personnel who are on the site and make things easier and safer. High reactivity of nanoparticles together with aging issue requires good quality control of the material which is injected. Here is a list of various characterization techniques used for analysis of nanoparticles, where most of them are pretty sophisticated and also expensive, but they provide very good picture on product characteristics. Unfortunately, most of them cannot be used directly in the field during application because they are usually placed in some research organizations, and as I said, they are pretty sophisticated. So that's why we provide following equipment, which is very easy for analysis of zero-valent iron content, which drives the reduction capacity of the product. The measurement takes about 20 minutes, and it can be done very easily in the field to provide quite precise picture of possible product age. And you can see it also in comparison with other measuring methods like X-ray powder diffraction or Metzbauer spectroscopy. It gives pretty good results, I think. I have been asked by Dr. Masale to say also something about column study. I think this is a great tool for comparison of various products or for product development under artificial laboratory conditions. On the other hand, I wouldn't spend too much time with column experiments with soil samples on a real site. It will not provide a representative picture unless the site is perfectly homogeneous. So I think it is better to carry out a small pilot study rather than the column experiment to get a more experience also on the injection handling of the material and so on. Anyway, there is a scheme of column experiment, how it's done on a Czech university in Liberec. And you can see also, hopefully, some pictures of moving nanoscale iron in columns during this experiment. Health and safety, this is one part of this event, so I would like to spend some time here and share with you our experience and perspective on these issues. First, we consider health and safety as very important, and it's very important to study and understand the product behavior. Unfortunately, it's a long-term process which takes really a lot of time and resources. So in the short time, what we can do, and I spoke about it already, we can reduce the risk by minimizing the contact with nanoparticles by using proper technology and equipment. We are even able to control agglomeration of nanoparticles in the subsurface, for example, by application of calcium chloride, which causes agglomeration of the particles. So in the case that the particles are migrating somewhere you don't want them, you can apply calcium chloride. It causes the agglomeration and the particles stops moving. There are already some studies dealing with fate of nanoparticles in environment showing that NZDI transformed to iron oxide and hydroxide depending on conditions. And these compounds are very common in environment. I think that some of the recent studies are made by Boltrotnik, and it looks pretty interesting. There is also a NanoRem project dealing with these issues, but I will talk about it later on the following slide. First thing, there are already several studies dealing with also with toxicity of nanoparticles, mainly using nanoscale 0-1 iron. You can see two recent ones where our product has been studied. And here is a short example how the study could look like. This is the toxicity of the NZDI on various kinds of organisms. This study has been done within NanoRem project. And you can see two different types of zero-valent iron. So both products are nanoscale irons, but the production method is different. And the VI called B is made from borohydride. So this is the liquid phase reduction, while nanofer-25S is made from these solid particles. This is our product. And both products were applied to the mixture of soil, water, some DDT, some DDT contamination, and various effects were studied. You can see that the DDT reduction rate was higher in case of borohydride iron because it probably had smaller particles, but our products still exhibited quite good reduction rate. But if you look, on the other hand, on the toxicity, you can see that the borohydride iron was much more toxic comparing to ours. And the explanation was that it's probably due to some residual of borohydride or maybe some antibacterial properties of boron itself. Anyway, the important thing that I wanted to say that the production method itself can affect the properties of the particles that are nanoscale, that all are nanoscale, but they have different behavior. Now we are approaching to the second part of the presentation dedicated to site, practical site experience. When someone wants to apply this technology, there are usually several concerns depending on experience with this technology. There are usually concerns on implementation, regulatory approval, how the product is delivered and applied. So I would like to talk about these aspects in the first slide. Treatability study is very important in the beginning of the presentation to get a picture if it has sense to apply nanoparticles in the given site. So usually groundwater soil is taken from the site and mixed with samples of nanoscale iron, and degradation rate and other parameters are observed. In case that we have good results, we can think about field pilot application to evaluate that what worked in the laboratory will also work on the site. And in case of successful field pilot application, we can think about full-scale remediation. However, the regulatory approval, which is necessary for deployment of nanoparticles in the field, it's unfortunately very country-specific problem, and many times it's also a region-specific procedure. In countries like Czech Republic or USA with many experience with this technology, it shouldn't be a big issue, but in countries with no experience, it might be quite difficult. Now I would like to present two sites, the representative ones, where NZDI has been deployed. First site, it's a former preprocessing site, contaminated fluorinated ethene and hexavalent chromium. The site is remediated maybe for 20 years by various techniques, which was pump and treat, venting, vapor deposition, in-situ chemical oxidation, which by the way caused the increase in hexavalent chromium presence in groundwater. And the last was sodium dicyanide, which was used to reduce the chromium. And because mentioned methods were not able to further degrade the contamination on this site, it has been decided to try the NZDI. So laboratory study was started first. You can see very nice typical yellow water of hexavalent chromium when it's presented in the water. And there should be also some degradation graphs. You can see that the PC was degraded in several days, and hexavalent chromium was reduced practically immediately after the application of nanoparticles, which is also presented on the bottom of this slide. On this picture, to the right vessel, the particles were applied, mixed, and separated by this magnet in the middle. And the whole experiment took about maybe 5 minutes. And you can see the water is perfectly clean. And if you make the analysis, you won't find any hexavalent chromium there. So the reaction with chromium is very fast due to high surface area of nanoparticles. After a successful laboratory study, a pilot application was done, 200 kilograms of slurry were applied into the two injection wells on a small spot in the middle of the site. And you can see the evolution of contamination. You can see the evolution of contaminants within approximately 2 months. Hexavalent chromium dropped down from 42 milligrams to a level below detection limit, and also chlorinated hydrocarbons decreased by two orders of magnitude there during the pilot study. So it was decided to apply NZVI in the full scale, and now you can see three following slides how the contamination clouds were shrinking. So this is the picture from October 2012. This is from January 2013. And this is January 2014. You can see the technology on the site directly from the, you can see the picture of the technology directly from the site. Second site is it's chemical factory where chlorinated products have been produced and stored. Contamination, migration, transformation of nanoparticles, and also changes in toxicity is monitored here to understand behavior and fate of nanoparticles in real environment. Samples are taken from drill cores, water, sediments, monitoring wells, as well as injected particles. And the pilot site is actually just a small place here on the bottom behind the permeable barrier, which protects the big source to spread far from the factory. Here is a graph after the application, so you can hopefully see the decrease in contaminants and typical rebound effect because the amount of particles, considering the size of the area, wasn't very big. Here you can see the core sample, typical black color caused by nanoparticles. Maybe it's not seen here, but there are also very small, tiny black spots that the particles penetrate through the soil. You can see here also some pictures from a microscope evaluating the presence of nanoparticles in different structures. And here is, I think, measurement of susceptibility to detect the particles directly in the subsurface. And here are another core samples with the analysis. In this case, I think it's mass power spectroscopy to detect various phases of zero valent iron oxide, and other byproducts. Work carried out on this site is done within EU project called NanoREM, which focuses on facilitating practical, safe, economical, and exploitable technology for in-situ remediation. Results of the site shall be presented at the end of this project, so we should get them like within 1 year. And this project will hopefully bring comprehensive insight on nanomaterials used to solve environmental issues. This is our just two sites shown as example. We have plenty other sites where our products were deployed. You can see a short list. And I think it's not necessary to comment it further. And to make some short conclusion of the presentation, I would like to say from my experience, the NZVI were always applied to the problematic sites. So we can say it's the technology which worked where the others fail. And lately, it's demonstrated that this technology maybe work better with a combination of bioremediation than alone. So this is this is something what we would like to study in the future. What we are also trying to do is further develop the product, so make it better, make it more reactive for some applications, make it more stable for different contaminants, make it more mobile. There are some interest in modified products, for example, with carbon or other metals to improve properties of the product. We are also interested in development of other iron-based products like potassium ferrate, but this is another technology. I talked about NanoRAM project, so nanoparticles shall be comprehensively evaluated here, and as I said already before, it's important to understand how the product behaves. I would like to thank our partners who provided information for my presentation to the NanoRAM project, and special thanks to guys organizing this event. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jan. We did get a number of questions regarding your presentation. I'm going to take just one or two of them right now, and then we'll move on to the next presentation and hold the bulk of them towards the Q&A period at the end of today's broadcast. But let me take first a question in reference to slide number 13. I'm not sure if you can navigate back towards slide number 13. And one of our participants just asked if there were short-term or long-term toxicity studies in relation to the information from this slide.
This study was just some basic study in laboratory to get the first data. Actually, you can find the article, the full article on the internet about this study. What's done within the NanoRAM project is the evaluation of the toxicity when the material is deployed on the site. So this is something what can be observed in a real environment, which is, by my opinion, much better than doing it in a laboratory. But it's a long-term process, as I mentioned. So I guess we will have some data, particularly from NanoRAM project, but it will be probably published at the end of the project, which will be next year, I guess.
All right, excellent. And we did have a few questions that kind of came into handling the materials and training that your company might provide regarding the equipment that you're producing. So do you have any personal protective precautions or personal contact precautions that you use when working with these materials?
Yes, it's basically everything is written in our safety material data sheet, and usually, and it's very common when somebody wants to apply a real project, we are traveling to the site to train the people or help them to apply the particles, especially when this is their first time, because by my experience, there are things, because the material is very reactive, as I said, that there are many things that can be done wrong. So for us, the result of the application is very important. That's why we are trying to support the guys trying to use this material by helping them directly in the field. So we provide sort of the training how to handle, apply the material, even how to design the application. So yeah.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much. I think we're going to move on to our very next presentation, but I do note that there are several additional questions still in the queue. We'll try to circle back to some of those. Our very next presenter will be Dr. Chunming Su, who's joining us as a soil scientist from the U.S. EPA's Ada, Oklahoma lab. Dr. Su, I'm going to take you off of mute right now. And let's see, again, Dr. Su, if we have you on the line, you can feel free. Let me call up the deck at the very beginning here for you. And you should be able to kick off your presentation whenever you're prepared to begin.
Yes, Jean, can you hear me?
I can.
Hello, everyone. I would like to thank Jean and Ephraim for organizing this webinar. I'm a soil scientist with the U.S. EPA Office of Research and Development. Today, I'm going to talk about a case study of a six-year field test of emulsified zero valent ion to treat a solstorm chloride solvents at the superfund site. This research is a collaboration among EPA, Geosyntec, NASA, and U.S. Navy. Let me move to the next slide. Looks like I cannot change to the next slide. Okay. Emulsified zero valent ion is a patent developed by NASA and the University of South Florida. Here I have a cartoon showing the structure of a typical EZVI droplet. Inside we have nanosized zero valent ion, and okay, and outside we have a membrane of the oil and with the surfactant, and below is a typical optical microscope picture of a drop of the EZVI. The diameter is about 12 micrometers. You can see here the oil surfactant membrane. And the idea is that the oil layer is miscible with the dinapple, and chlorine solvents can diffuse through the oil membrane and are degraded in the presence of the ZVI in the interior of the emulsion. EZVI can be used to enhance degradation by dinapple by enhancing contact between dinapple and the ZVI particles. Due to the vegetable oil and surfactant, which will also act as the long-term electron donors, EZVI will also promote anaerobic biodegradation. The objective of this research are to evaluate two injection technologies, pneumatic and direct injection, within the dinapple source zone for EZVI delivery. The reason why we choose the two injection technologies is because NASA has done a preliminary research testing 5 to 7 injection methods, and they decided that the pneumatic injection, direct injection are the two most appropriate methods. The second objective is to evaluate the effectiveness of EZVI to decrease mass flux of dissolved volatile organic compounds. And we also wanted to look at the fate and transport of injected nano EZVI and to see what happened once they have been injected. The testing site was Paris Island in South Carolina. It's a Marine Corps base. It has free phase dinapple at the site, and it has easy access, and we have very good study support. The location of the contamination was a former dry cleaner facility here. The building was torn down, and the source area was located around the above and the below ground storage tanks. 1994 PC spit out. We collected the soil cores and groundwater samples in 2005 and 2006 to evaluate the contaminant distribution, and we installed wells in 2006 in those areas. And we identified two source areas, the smaller one and the big one. These are the soil core locations. And we have a multiple monitoring wells, PMW 1, 2, and 3, 4, 5, 6 are the forest green monitoring wells. And then we have multiple level monitoring wells. ML1 and 2 are the upper gradient monitoring wells. Down gradient wells are from ML3 through ML7. The groundwater flows from northwest to southeast direction, and the flow rate is very low, about 0.1 to 0.2 feet per day. In this smaller source zone, we use direct injection to target a total of about 155 grams of VOCs. And in the bigger pneumatic injection plot, we targeted about 38 kilograms of total contaminants. We did the baseline characterization before injection, collected samples for a variety of field parameters such as dissolved oxygen, oxidation reduction potential, pH conductivity, turbidity, CVOCs, and dissolved hydrocarbon gases, volatile fatty acids, anions, alkalinity, TOC, TIC, and some isotopes. We also did an integral pump test to estimate the total mass flux. As you can see here, we have the sample in this well, ML223, I think, the bottom. We made the EDVR at the site because EDVR was only stable for about a week, so we had to make it on the site and immediately inject it into the subsurface. Basically, we combined total ion size range from 35 to 140 nanometers, 10% by weight, and we mixed with corn oil, about 38%, surfactant, 1%, and the rest, 51% of tap water. And we mixed everything into a drum and mixed using the industrial mixer, and then we pumped this into the drum, and this is the final product of the EZVI. This slide shows the lithography of the two different plots. Basically, in the direct injection plot, we have sand below COD sand layer. And then we have sand. At the bottom, we have a peat layer at about 6 meters. In the pneumatic injection plot, a similar lithography with the COD clay lower in depth. And again, at the bottom, we have a peat layer. Now, to do the injection, as you can see in the pneumatic injection plot, once we did injection, we tried to do it from the angles from the other side plot to try to prevent the DNAPO from escaping other side of the test plot. As you can see, when we did the injection, we had some daylighting. Some of the injected EDVI came out above ground. Fortunately, most of the EDVI, about 90% of the volume, was able to get inside. We had about 10% of EDVI daylighting. In the direct injection plot, we used a direct push geoplop to deliver about 150 gallons of EDVI at four locations. Again, we saw some daylighting, these pictures show you around Monitor Well ML3 pad. We had daylighting of the injected EZVI. After injection, we collected soil cores and we opened them and visually inspected the presence of EZVI. Because the EZVI is black and it's shining under the daylight, so it was easy to identify. And after injection at different time, we collected soil cores and we tried to estimate the distance of the EZVI that traveled after injection. And this is challenging because you really don't know where the EZVI is actually from once you have a soil core that shows the presence of EZVI. So we used a conservative method. The distance of EZVI traveled is estimated as the distance between the soil core and the closest injection point. By this way, we estimated that for the pneumatic injection plot, the EZVI traveled about 2.1 meters at least. And using the same method for the direct injection plot, we estimate that about 0.9 meters the travel distance of EZVI was about 0.9 meters. We conducted performance monitoring after injection, and basically we sampled for the same parameters as the baseline event. Now let's look at some of the data, and this shows the concentrations and your chemical parameters for monitoring well ML23. As you can remember, ML23 is one of the two upgraded multiple level monitoring wells. As you can see, the PC and TC concentrations decreased rapidly after injection. However, the CCDC showed only a brief decrease after EZVI injection, and it then bounced back. However, over time, it was able to decrease, and after 60 years, it's still lower than the highest point before injection. The monochloride concentrations, however, increased over time. And the ASIN concentrations increased steadily after injection and maintained at relatively high levels. Methane concentration increased after 6 years, but it's relatively low compared to the concentration of ASIN. The redox potential decreased after injection, and then slowly it bounced back. For the pH, before injection it's about 6.4. After injection, it was decreased to as low as near 5.6 and maintained at low levels. The reason we see the decrease in pH could be from the decomposition of corn oil that released acids and other simple organic acids. The other reason is that the chlorination of a PCN and TC would release hydrogen ions into the solution. The dissolved ferrous ion concentrations was very high right after injection at about 550 ppm. and it decreased over time. The dissolved sulfide was relatively low. Now we're looking at ML75, that is a downgradient multiple level monitoring well. Again, the PC and TC concentrations quickly decreased to negligible levels after injection. However, CSTC increased over time, and after 6 years, finally it trended down. The dissolved methane concentrations increased over time, and the ethane concentrations increased after injection and peaked up at about 2.5 years, and then came down. Again, the redox potential decreased after injection and then bounced back. pH dramatically decreased from about 6.4 to about 5, and then bounced back. The dissolved iron concentration again increased over time, and dissolved sulfide also increased after injection. PMW3 is a downgradient fully screened monitoring well for the pneumatic injection plot. We saw similar things here. PC concentrations quickly decreased after injection, and the CSTC concentrations were variable, and they also reached to very low levels about 4 years after injection, and then at about 6 years, it bounced back. So for this plot, a single injection of EZVI was able to maintain the low concentrations of CVOCs for at about 4 years. And again, dissolved methane concentration increased over time, and ethane concentrations also increased over time. We see similar trends for pH, EH, dissolved iron, and dissolved sulfide. PMW1 is a downgradient monitoring well for the direct injection plot. We can see here that CSTC concentrations and monochloride concentrations along with the PC, TC concentrations all decreased after injection to very low levels, and they never come back even after 6 years. For the dissolved methane concentrations increased over time and then leveled off. The pH values were kind of steady, and the redox potential decreased and then bounced back. Again, we see similar trend for dissolved iron. The highest concentration we saw was about 120 ppm, and now it went down over time. So far, I have talked about the changes in contaminant concentrations. Another important aspect of looking at the effectiveness is to compare the mass flux of contaminants before and after injection. As you can see for TC, PC, mass flux for the upgrading, we saw spikes in 2007 and then decreased over time. For TCE, we saw slight increase over time. For CSTCE, also slight increase over time. However, for the mass flux of monochloride, We saw the highest one after about 4 years, and after 6 years, it finally came down. An interesting trend is seen here for the mass flux of ethane. You see, we have this steady increase of ethane after injection, because ethane is a dechlorination product of PC and TC and CCC. The increase in the mass flux in ethane is a good indication that the dechlorination process is occurring. And these are the mass fluxes for the down gradient wells ML3 through ML7. For the vinyl chloride, we again see a spike and then decrease over time. For the ethane mass flux, we see increasing trend and then over time decrease. Again, the ethane mass flux changes tells us that the treatment of the enamel is occurring at the site. This table shows you the total mass changes before and after injection. For the absorbed and dissolved phase, we were able to achieve a 23% reduction. For the denapo phase, we were able to achieve a 95% reduction. Overall, we were able to achieve a 78% reduction in total mass of contaminants after single injection of EZVI. What happened to the injected ion? We used X-ray diffraction to characterize the solids collected from well purging water. As you can see here, the solids collected from ML3.3-1 showed the presence of mostly magnetite, a little bit of zero-valent ion. And the magnetite is a major product of the ion corrosion over time. However, the magnetite can be also changed to other ion oxides like leptochloroside and goethite in this case. We also collected soil cores and did X-ray diffraction. As you can see that we were able to see magnetite peaks in the whole soil core samples. Again, we also see pyrite, which might be the native mineral in the soil, and it could be also a product of the iron corrosion process. We used the scanning electron microscope to examine the morphology changes of the iron. Before injection, most of ions are spherical aggregates. And after injection, some of the ion has changed into cube-like particles. Those are typical magnetite particles. And in some cases, we see these rod-like crystals. And I think those are goethite particles. What are the mechanisms of dechlorination at the site? There are many possible degradation pathways. And here I have listed about 18, 19 steps here. We started with the PCE, and some of the PCE would be degraded to TCE through microbial process. And it is believed that for the fluorovalent ion, the direct dechlorination through this acetylene step is dominant. However, at this site, we have seen a lot of CDC and monochloride in groundwater. So we also think that after a few months, when the NZVI completely corroded away the biological degradation pathways were dominant. In conclusion, injected nanoion was transformed to iron oxide with greater particle size, mostly within 3 months. And we were unable to detect the fluorovalent ion in the samples basically after 3 months in many monitoring wells. EZVR resulted in more reducing conditions that stimulated dechlorinating bacteria. I didn't talk about the bacteria population changes. We did collect the soil cores and send them to a commercial lab, analyzed for the presence of the heterochoides. And we were able to see up to 10 to the power of 5 increase in the population of the heterochoides after injection. In some places. The radius of influence was as much as 2 meters with pneumatic injection and about 0.9 meters with direct injection. And there were significant reductions in the downgrading groundwater mass flux. And there were significant reduction in total VOC and DNAPL. Includes that EZVR technology can be successfully applied to treat soil-borne DNAPL. I would like to acknowledge a lot of people who have contributed to this project. Thank you very much.
And thank you. Thank you so very much, Dr. Hsu. We've had many questions come in regarding your presentation. I'm going to take just one topic that several people asked about right now. We'll ask that, and then we'll hold the other questions until our break towards the end. Several participants asked specifically how much pressure was applied during the pneumatic injection.
As I remember, it was several hundred PSI. And we hired a commercial injection company to do the injection. For the pneumatic injection, basically we used the high-pressure oxygen gas to create the fractures in the subsurface first. And then we injected the EZVI after that. So it's a very high pressure, and of course the safety is very important. So we made sure that when we did the injection, people are away from the injection point.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much. And again, we do have several other questions in the queue for you, so we'll circle back to those. And let's move on in the interest of time to the very next presenter. We're next going to be joined by Dr. Mark Hoover, who is a senior research scientist at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. Dr. Hoover, if you are on the line, let me take you off of mute and feel free to begin.
Great. Thanks very much, Jean. How am I coming through?
You're coming through loud and clear.
Excellent. Well, it's a pleasure to be part of today's NanoPRM webinar to engage with you on our opportunity to harness nanoinformatics for impact in environmental remediation. As noted in this next slide, our NanoPRM website lists our premise as that we can identify and address the occupational and non-occupational hazards and opportunities of engineered nanoparticles in environmental remediation through what we're calling a knowledge infrastructure. So in today's webinar so far, you've heard about some real-world issues that we're addressing at the grassroots level. And we do believe that success in our efforts requires substantial grassroots involvement. So thank you for engaging with us to define and apply nanoparticle informatics in a manner that will have measurable and positive impact for you in particular and for the community in general. In this next slide, we see the a website, nanoinformatics. The web link is at the bottom, and a key community connection that many of you will recognize is the grounding of our nanoparticle approach in the community-based development of the Nanoinformatics 2020 Roadmap. For more than a decade now, many, many volunteers have come together in what we call our Nanoinformatics Community of Practice to engage the actual experience and involvement of real people doing real things to achieve real outcomes with real nanomaterials. And the details of the roadmap can be found at the website listed below. And we invite you to help us advance and implement the Nanoinformatics 2020 Roadmap. The next slide shows a key federal nanotechnology connection that many of you will also recognize, and that's the partnering we're doing across federal agencies under the auspices of the National Nanotechnology Coordination Office. Presentations from the NNCO were an important part of our NanoForM workshop in 2013, and we invite you to visit the nano.gov website for details on a wide range of NNCO activities that are ongoing. Of particular interest to our NanoForM work are the NNCO activities to develop the signature initiative for a nanotechnology knowledge infrastructure and to develop a signature initiative on sensors. Both of those topics are being covered by the NNCO and participating agencies in an ongoing series of webinars. So please see the nano.gov website for details. In this next slide, our approach to building a robust and sustainable nanotechnology knowledge infrastructure has involved a core effort to define what we hope will prove to be a credible set of nanoinformatics principles and practices. As many of you already know, we have a community-based collaboration to create a reference text on nanoinformatics principles and practices, and we invite you to be involved. The NanoForM experience will be an important component of that reference text. I hope that many of you will give me a call to talk more about how you can help. As shown in this slide, our process of defining nanoinformatics for impact has required us to address the classic who, what, when, where, why, and how question. This is truly a work in progress, and we need the benefit of your experience and your specific programmatic and mission needs. In this next slide, expanding on our efforts to understand who we are and what we need, this slide displays our current matrix view of our unique needs and contributions as either workers, health and safety practitioners, managers, policymakers, regulators, equipment and facility providers, materials suppliers, financiers, insurers, members of the legal community, researchers, educators, students, emergency responders, the media, consumers, and members of the general society. We think we have a home for everyone, and we think we need the involvement of everyone. This next slide presents our working definition of nanoinformatics. We've created it to be comprehensive in detail because we think that attention to details is essential to get the right things done right. We invite you to read the details of the definition in the slide set that will be available online after today's webinar. And in the next slide, let's look at a graphical version of our informatics life cycle. As shown in this life cycle, two elements appear with particular prominence. They are the key essential step at the very beginning to set mission objectives, and then the key assessment step to confirm the effectiveness of our efforts. The details of those efforts must be tailored to each of our unique objectives, and in each step along the way, each of us needs to take credible actions to determine relevance and reliability goals for our data needs, and then to collect and create and collect, validate and store, share, analyze, and model, and apply that data. After confirming whether we've achieved our objectives and deciding how to improve our performance, we need to convey our experience to the community, contribute to generalized knowledge, and ultimately update guidance standards and training to support the next generation of our work. It truly is a life cycle. As shown in this interactive slide, a network of nodes and interfaces comprises what we consider informatics to be and how we can apply for impact in our own missions by understanding and carrying out our roles and responsibilities as either a data customer or a data creator or a data curator or a data analyst. Sometimes we wear all four hats. Sometimes we change back and forth among hats. But the pitfalls are clear. Our actions must be credible within each of the four nodes, as well as across each of the six interfaces. And actually, there are 12 interfaces if we take into account the fact that each interface must work in both directions. For example, just because the analyst has clearly articulated the data needs to run an applicable model doesn't mean that the data creators or the data curators are going to be able to appropriately translate and respond to those data needs. So, no wonder so many real-life efforts in the business of science and the business of business go so poorly. Good informatics is really not for dabblers, and there are a lot of moving parts. In this next slide, we believe that our ability to personalize informatics for impact in our own missions is key to our likelihood of success. As shown here in what I think is a delightful pun, we believe that the eyes are in the eye of the beholder. One size does not fit all. There are a lot of ways that we can imagine a relevant framework and implement a reliable process. So in this slide, it's an example of how we can expand on the use of the I words as an informatics for impact process in which we identify our own mission objectives and our own information needs, then initiate a plan to gather, examine, and evaluate that information. Then we investigate to detect, collect, and inspect the relevant information. Then we incorporate our findings and conclusions into our everyday practices so that we can beneficially impact workers, consumers, and communities. And finally, we improve by confirming the outcomes we achieved and by making adjustments as needed. We believe that informatics for impact is a generalizable framework because we recognize the details of the process can and must be personalized. One size does not fit all. The eyes are in the eye of the beholder. We basically need to plan, do, check, and adjust. And many of you will recognize that as the well-established business management mantra of the Deming cycle. In this next slide, it's a pleasure to note how many valuable activities are already underway in the nanotechnology knowledge infrastructure. And this is just here in the U.S. Across the country, you can access data from the NIST Material Measurement Laboratory, simulation tools from NanoHub, characterization protocols and results from the CA NanoLab, examples of good industrial hygiene practice from the Good Nano Guide, and curated information about specific nanomaterials from the Nanomaterial Registry. In the lower right-hand corner, you'll see our logo. Our drill down into Nano4REM is benefiting from the broader partnering efforts in the NKI, and the NKI is benefiting from our lessons learned in Nano4REM. And now, in the penultimate slide of this introduction to harnessing nanoinformatics, this Venn diagram conveys our work as a focus of the convergence of three areas. The first is the pursuit of safety, health, well-being, and productivity, which is common to everything we do. Essentially, no one wants to do anything in a manner that's unsafe or unproductive. But the conscious convergence of that area with risk management enables us to critically assess the extent to which anything that we do actually affects the bottom line. We need good yardsticks. We need to ask the hard questions. Is what we want to measure or what we want to study or what we want to change really important to meeting our mission goals? We can't afford to fritter away our resources on things that don't matter. And finally, the NKI places the streetlight at the intersection of nanotechnology and commerce. And Nano4REM places the streetlight in the area of environmental remediation. So a focus on the convergence, we think, is a focus on success. So in this final slide, we highlight the fact that we're engaged in a four-step process of community action to build and sustain leaders, cultures, and systems for safety, health, well-being, and productivity. In our focus on Nano4REM, today's reality for environmental remediation is what it is, and we know that we face many challenges. But tomorrow's reality for environmental remediation can be what we make of it. So we're engaging the community, informing the interested, and hopefully rewarding the responsive. That's all of you. And we ultimately need to understand and incentivize the reluctant. That old saw, lead, follow, or get out of the way, applies to what we're doing. Thank you for engaging with us. We hope that your involvement and the application of what you've learned will prove to be rewarding to you. That concludes my remarks on nanoinformatics for impact, and I look forward to some interesting discussions with you at the end of the webinar. And please do feel free to contact me at any time to follow up on anything that you feel I might be able to help you with. So, back to you, Jean.
Great. Thank you so very much, Dr. Hoover. We did have one question that came in regarding what you just talked about with all of the different players and entities that seem to be involved in nanotechnology and in nanoinformatics. Can you talk a little bit about how your informatics work is helping to rapidly share information that might be coming from these different players?
Well, I think one of the things that's really been developing is in each community of practice, and if we take Nano4M as one of the communities of practice, and you look at the long history of Kluin and the amount of information that's available there, I think that's a good example of where, as a community, we're learning where do we go when we need to find information. And then Ephraim, Dr. Massawe, had done an interesting survey several years ago where he asked stakeholders in states, what do you have for situations involving nanotechnology, the convergence of nanotechnology and environmental remediation? Where do you get your information? What are the questions that you're asking? So I think that we mentioned the Good Nano Guide as a place where you could go. I think that's an emerging resource for people on health and safety information. So I think we're getting some traction, but it does take a lot of community involvement to make sure that the people who can organize the information have a place to put it, and then we know it's there, and we can improve it and improve it.
Excellent. Thank you so very much. I appreciate that. I think we're going to move on to our very next presentation, but again, we do have additional time for Q&A slated at the end. So let me call up our very next presentation and move along. Dr. Lorraine Day will be joining us, who is a CMD and an LSU Safety Administrator in Baton Rouge. Lorraine, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. I went to hit the talk button, and somehow I'm here.
Well, please feel free to begin.
Well, good morning, or afternoon, as the case may be. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. Thank you, Mark, also for some really interesting and insightful comments on nanoinformatics. I also am looking at considerations for customers, creators, curators, and analysts. In this particular session, I would like to just touch on a couple of examples of radioactivity-related examples of Nano4M. Both Mark and I are sort of co-chairs of the Nanotechnology Committee of the Health Physics Society. I'd also like to make at the end a couple of comments on nanosafety. So the first one is a bacterial enhanced cleanup of uranium. The second is graphene removal of uranium and plutonium. And the third is new tools for discovery and research. In the first example, the second slide, please, thank you, is bacterial enhanced cleanup of uranium. Now, this is very interesting because those of you who have heard of placer gold will understand that that is also a bacterial process in which the gold condenses onto a bacterium, which then collects other bacterium, and you get nuggets and things like this, and it's placer gold. In this way, we are also making sort of placer uranium. The bacteria are using a change in valence state from the uranium, which is sitting in, it turns out that uranium mine tailings are in water, but they exist as nanoparticles. Uranium is not especially dissolvable in water, so it's not a complete surprise. So what happens now is that the bacteria are causing a change in the uranium. The uranium is plating out, and it's much easier to filter out bacteria, obviously, than which are about at least 1,000 times larger than nanomaterials. And so the mineralogy is still up in the air, but this was a brand new study that was first published on the 17th of June. Now moving on to the next one, So the first one was a problem with nano-uranium being in water. In this case, we are using, I apologize, this is a typo there, graphene should be P-H-E-N-E. And here we are using graphene, which is basically, you've all heard of carbon nanotubes. Graphene is simply a two-dimensional representation of a carbon nanotube. In other words, it's not rolled up into a three-dimensional piece. And it is carbon-based and therefore more or less soluble in water. And when the graphene has some very unique characteristics, amongst them being very unique electrical properties. And as you move contaminated liquid streams of uranium and plutonium, they mix with the graphene and they can be precipitated out of solution. So here we are able to remove uranium and plutonium nanoparticles from liquid streams. This is due in part because of the extremely large surface area for absorption by graphene, then the favorable surface chemistry and electrical components, if you wish. So you can collect that material now in situ. It can be removed for safe disposal or could be recovered for reuse. Plutonium is certainly not an inexpensive material, and there are conditions where you would like to reuse and have that material accessible to you for reuse once again. Now, on the next slide, we're talking about a very interesting National Center for Electron Microscopy, which is a DOE national user facility. What this team has been able to do is to produce an electron microscope that has a resolution of 0.5 angstrom, which is less than the diameter of a single hydrogen atom. Why is this important? Well, I think that all of the new tools and discovery and research that is coming out is instrumental in us understanding better what is going on in the nano world. That's because size, shape, agglomeration are all predictors of functionality, though that is not the whole story. What we need in conjunction with the nano-for-REM applications are new and better tools for nano-characterization. And along with this characterization, we can use these technological tools to predict nanotoxicity. I know that Jan, for example, spoke to us about aging, and Stegemeyer in just this year showed that there was very different uptake in plants for aged versus pristine nanoparticles. Also, we know that it's very very complex to understand the health and safety issues at the nano level. We are aware, for example, that nitrogen-fixing bacteria, for example, that are used in growing clover or soybeans, are at least 1 million times more sensitive than other soil bacteria to the effects of nanomaterials. Why this happens is still a mystery, why they are more exquisitely sensitive. We also know that how the nanoparticle is presented to higher organisms, such as snails, it differs. For example, if you look at silver uptake, dissolved ions and nanomaterials and how they are incorporated into the snail depend on whether the snails are exposed in the diet or via water that they consume. So it is, I think, just to sum up a little bit, the actual problem of nanosafety is a very complicated one. I think we're going to have to use some interesting tools such as quantitative structure-activity relationships and computational models that will help us elicit specific structures and hopefully try to relate those to particular properties or responses in situ and in vivo. So thank you.
Thank you so very much. I think just that we are coming right near our last presentation slated for the agenda, and that portion will involve some wrap-up and open Q&A time. So I think what I'm going to do, Lorraine, is to actually move on to the final presentation with Dr. Misawe, where we'll have some additional Q&A time, and we'll integrate any questions for you into that time. So Dr. Misawe, if you are still with us on the phones, I'm calling up your wrap-up presentations, and I'll invite you to come off of mute and walk us through some of your wrap-up comments and continue on with our open Q&A period. Dr. Misawe? Oh, here, let me help you. If you are now off of mute, go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, all of you, for participating in this webinar forum. I hope you've enjoyed and learned a lot from the panelists today. Today's session is a reflection of what we are advocating for sharing of information at the local level, the national level, and international level. Jean, could you help us move to the next slide, please? So today's session is a reflection of what we are advocating for sharing of information at the local, national, and international level. We've seen case studies from Europe, from the United States, and the nanoinformatics framework that we are trying to develop. Now we have begun yet another phase of our Nano Forum initiative. Questions that we need to ponder as a group now is, where would you like to go from here? How often would you like to see these types of meetings held? Or what topics, specific topics, would you like to recommend? So I open the floor now for suggestions, ideas, questions, and so on. So if you will, go to the next slide, please, if we have one. Okay, so questions, comments at this time? Time is open for you for suggestions.
Okay, so with that, I'll invite participants to use that Q&A window to start typing up some questions or suggestions and ideas, as Dr. Misawe has invited you all to do in the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. While we wait for some participants to start sharing some of their suggested topics or ideas, if it's okay, Dr. Misawe, I think I'm going to circle back to a few questions that we had for some of the earlier presenters, if that's all right.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And I do see some topics and suggestions coming in, so that's great. Thank you. Continue to send those in, and let's circle back to some questions. I'm going to go back to Dr. Sue's presentation. And Dr. Sue, if you are with us on the phones, I will make sure you are off of mute if you like, and feel free to chime in on the phones here. We had a few participants ask if the results from your Paris Island were published or released anywhere.
Yes, Jean, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, the results of the 2.5-year monitoring for the Paris Island site have been published in Water Research in two journal articles. And if anybody is interested, they can send me an email. I can send them the PDF files of the two published papers. Right now, I'm trying to write up a book chapter to summarize the six-year performance evaluation.
All right, excellent. And just a reminder, we will remind everyone how you can find contact information for all of our instructors before we close out. So thank you for that. Dr. Sue, I'm going to take another question. And this one, Jan, if you're also on the line, they're going to open this question up to you. So let's start with Dr. Sue first, and then Jan, if you want to come off of mute and chime in, that would be great. This participant is asking, do you think that nano-ZVI remediation is an effective way to clean up, especially when you're looking at mixed contamination scenarios where you have organic and inorganic contamination at the same time? So Dr. Sue, based off of your work, do you think that that's an effective way when you're looking at mixed contamination zones?
I would say it depends. because the NCVI would go through corrosion and it will reduce contaminants. For example, if you have a mixed PC, TC, plume or source zone with hexavalent chromium, chrome 6, that would be a good way. You know, you can inject the CVI or ECVI to treat both PC and hexavalent chromium. Hexavalent chromium would be reduced to the trivalent form. NCVI is a good adsorbent also for arsenic. So if you have a mixed contaminant of chlorine solvents and arsenic, you can do the same. Also, NCVI can be a catalyst for in situ oxidation reactions. People have tried to use NCVI or magnetite to activate persulfate oxidation of contaminants.
Well, let's see if Jan, are you on the line? Do you have anything to add or perhaps share your thoughts about using nano ZVI for cleaning up both inorganic and organic materials?
Yes, and I hope you can hear me.
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay. I think, as Dr. Su said, depends on the situation. In some cases, when there is a high concentration of inorganic phase, like, I don't know, nitrogen oxides, something like this, it can cause agglomeration of nanoparticles, and then it won't work. Or, for example, high salinity of the water can cause the agglomeration of the nanoparticles. So you cannot get the performance that you are expecting. That's also the reason why we are suggesting to do this laboratory experiment before injecting the material in the site to see what could be the result of the application. On the other hand, there are some very interesting combinations, like I showed in my presentation. When you have very high concentration of hexavalent chromium in the site, it's very toxic to microorganisms, so it's very hard to deploy biotreatment there. But if you use the NZDI in the first step, primary to reduce the hexavalent chromium, and then inject some substrate to support microbial activity, you can get very amazing results, at least by our experience. So it's a very specific issue.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to take another question and also send it to both Dr. Su and Jan. Let's first start with Dr. Su. And this one is regarding nano ZVI injection. One of our participants commented that typically when you use that technique, there's some level of surfacing. How do you mitigate exposure when that material surfaces in the system?
Fortunately, the ECVI is in the form of emulsion and it's not in the solid powder form. So as long as we avoid direct contact with the ECVI particles, we are fine. This injection would be best for the deep aquifer, where you have less chance of daylighting. For shallow aquifers like the Paris Island, it's only like 20 feet deep. You have a bigger chance of getting daylighting. Another lesson we learned from the demonstration is that when you do the injection, you want to make sure that you plug all the previous holes resulting from the soil coring, soil core collection. And also during the injection, once you see it's daylighted, it's better to go back and plug the fractures with bentonite or other materials and let it mature before you continue your injection.
All right. Jan, do you have any comments on that?
I'm not sure that I get the question, really. It was about daylighting, primarily, what we do when we observe the daylighting issue, or?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. We don't have many experience because pressure injection is not really popular in Czech, if I say it in this way. We usually do the gravity feed. But I saw some sites, and usually I would recommend to apply some sorbent, I think as Dr. Sue said, some bentonite, which will cause the sorption and mainly agglomeration of nanoparticles like calcium chloride, which will dramatically reduce the surface area of nanoparticles, decrease reactivity, and make the particles bigger. And finally, it's important to understand that it's still iron, I mean, chemically. Chemically, it's still iron, like microscale particles or some bigger forms. It's not an artificial chemical. So if we are able to agglomerate the particles, we basically dealing with the chemical same to other form, like non-nanoscale products.
Excellent. Thank you so very much. It looks like we have come to our scheduled end time, so I think I'd like to just circle back to some of the suggestions for topics. A number of you have submitted them. Dr. Misawi, I'm browsing through some of these topics for future dialogues, and the audience seems to be very interested in nano safety, nano handling and training, programs in place for monitoring health effects of nano exposure materials on workers. That seems to be the dominant concept, is just exposure, handling, and safety for nanomaterials. So I think let's go ahead and walk through any closeout statements that you might have, Dr. Misawi, and then I'll walk the audience through how they can follow up with additional questions, access materials, the recording, and share feedback for today's session.
Oh, thank you very much, Jean, and thank you, everybody, for attending this forum today. I would like to extend my appreciation to all the panelists for their highlights and their knowledge that I believe all of us have learned. And I also, above all, I want to appreciate your feedback and the suggested topics that you said you would like to see in the future. We'll compile all this information and circulate it to all webinar participants, and hopefully we can work on them. And together, I believe we can make a difference. Thank you very much, Jean, for arranging all this, and everybody.
Thank you so very much. And with that, let me go ahead and walk you through just a few final reminders as we close out today's webinar. I want to echo the thanks that Dr. Misawi did, as well as a number of the other presenters, for our very knowledgeable instructors pulling together their resources and sharing their time and information today. For those of you who are interested, we offer webinars like this on the Cleanup Information Network throughout the year, so you're certainly welcome to follow us or visit our websites. You can connect with us on popular social and professional networking sites if you'd like to learn more about these events. We do have certificates available for those of you who joined us for today's live broadcast. If you would like to receive one of these certificates, we will ask that you submit feedback for today's webinar. Once you fill out the online feedback form, which I'll direct you all to in just a moment, there will be a box that you can check to request a seminar certificate, and that will be emailed to you and also be immediately available to download or print as soon as you fill out the feedback form. So it'll look something like this once you fill out that form to download it and print it out. You can fill out feedback anytime after today's live delivery, so if you happen to be replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still share your thoughts on the recorded version. If you are looking for copies of the presentation material as well as the URLs that were shared today, we do have the URLs posted in the related URLs pod toward the middle right. We'll also have those along with the presentation slides posted to the resources or links page. That page is active, so a number of you have asked, and I've already shared that URL. You can go in there and download or print out the materials from that site at any time. As I mentioned earlier, contact information is available from the seminar homepage. That's also accessible under related URLs for the with the link labeled seminar homepage. On that page, you'll find contact information for each of our instructors, and you're certainly welcome to reach out to each of them directly if you have specific follow-on questions or ideas to share with them. For those questions that were submitted into the queue that we were unable to ask or answer during today's live broadcast, I'll be working to share those questions with our instructors after today's session. And I will ask, as I mentioned, just to take a moment to fill out our short online feedback form. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can fill out that form and let us know what you thought of today's session. As Dr. Misawi noted, please feel free to include your specific ideas for topics for future sessions that you'd like to see the nanotechnology group put their emphasis on. So with that, many thanks to the nearly 140 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live session.